Hey, great to be with you. Mark Stein here for another hour of questions from around the planet, live from Mark Stein Club members. It's 4 o'clock Eastern Time in North America. That's 9 o'clock at the Greenwich Meridian in London, 10 o'clock in Europe, 11 o'clock in the Middle East, some god-awful hour of the night for most of our Asian club members, and an early breakfast in Australia and slightly more civilized hour for the Kiwis and our many Pacific Islander members in Vanuatu and Tuvalu and the Solomon Islands and the Cook Islands. Welcome to you all. It is September the 12th already in that part of the world, but still September the 11th here, the fifth anniversary of the Benghazi attack, and we have quite a bit of material on that subject at Stein Online. And it is also the 16th anniversary of 9/11. And this is the first year that I did not rerun a lot of material from 16 years ago about that grim day, September 11th, 2001, because to be honest, it's too depressing. And I didn't think that this is where we would be 16 years later. They said at the time that 9/11 was the day that, quote, everything changed. And if by everything changed you mean that the rate of mass Muslim immigration to the West doubled, then yes, it did change. And partly as a consequence of that rather bizarre byproduct of 9/11, we find ourselves here 16 years on, fighting for absolutely barren and worthless bits of sod like Helmand Province in Afghanistan, for example, while surrendering some of the most valuable and highly developed real estate on the planet, such as Sweden and France. We have more or less learned entirely the wrong lessons of 9/11 and spent 16 years pursuing phantoms. So ask me a question about 9/11 if you want, but the decision not to post any anniversary material was mine, and I take full responsibility for it. And in fact, we have a question from Deplorable Gal, who says, hi Mark, is it just me, or is the passive voice in all these tributes just another posthumous victory for the terrorists? Am I overthinking this? All this talk about towers falling, lives lost, those who died. How did this language become the acceptable language for murdered by Islamic terrorists? This isn't actually a new thing. I was very struck by that passivity on the first anniversary of September 11th in 2002. And in fact, I was actually struck by it within weeks of the attack itself. I remember driving through New Hampshire and hearing sort of rather weepy, maudlin, saccharine Hallmark greeting card piano music, such as would accompany a drippy movie on the Lifestyle Channel or whatever it's called. And already references to tragedy and the tragic events. It wasn't a tragic event. It was people who hate you trying to kill you. And there is something about the tone of the events. I was driving along, happened to be in the car at the exact moment, 16 years to the time the first tower was attacked, and they began the anniversary observances in 9/11 in Lower Manhattan with the recitation of the names of the dead from A to Z. And at a certain level, it is moving and dignified. But in the absence of anything else, it is also, as Deplorable Gal said, passive. And I think our enemies have figured that out. And that's why I chose to commemorate the fifth anniversary of Benghazi today, because in part it seems to me more telling. The need and the wish to deny the reality of what happened at Benghazi seems as revealing a glimpse into the psychosis afflicting America and the West as anything that happened on the day that supposedly everything changed. I regret saying that, but it saddens me to read the material I wrote on September 11th, September 12th, and the days that followed, and then to look at where we are now, 16 years later, and to look at the way, for example, free speech is being hollowed out by politicians around the world who pretend that Islamophobia, for example, is a real thing rather than a conscious strategy by those who despise core Western liberties like free speech to make us all shut up about some of the more obvious problems with that particular religion. And I was struck too by the absence of certain words in the 9/11 commemorations, starting with the most obvious word, Islam. So that's Deplorable Gal getting us off to a start today. Scott Barnhouse writes, Mark, you have often commented on the birth rate and the fact that once the birth rate is below a critical level, societies never recover. Is there a similar rule with regard to size of government largesse? I can think of no country that has ever reduced benefits to its citizens and survived. Can you help me with an optimistic example of how we could go forward? Thanks so much, says Scott. That's a very interesting question, Scott. At a certain level, these programs haven't been around too sufficiently long for us to make a determination about that. Welfare is, in the modern sense, was basically invented by Bismarck in Imperial Germany, and many other Western countries then started catching up in the mid-20th century, for example, Social Security in the United States. Essentially, what we have are a lot of mid-20th century welfare programs that have not taken account of declining birth rates and increasing life expectancy. So we don't really know whether there's a way back from that. And obviously, if you're heading towards the cliff, there's, you know, basically two things you can do. You can either go over the cliff or you can actually go into reverse and attempt to dial back some of those programs. And no society has really made a determined effort to do that. And it ties into, I think, the same psychosis that afflicts us with respect to 9/11 and the Islamization of the West, that at a certain level, we cannot grasp the scale of the change in mindset that is required. It's too much to ask. And in a sense, the theatrical gestures, which America in particular is very good at, these stupid, pointless fights about the debt ceiling, for example, which is really just a bit of dinner theatre, really, small government dinner theatre, completely irrelevant. That, I think, is grasping what is needed to change is too much to ask. And there's always another day or someone else to pass it on to. It's really one or the other. In Greece, for example, they don't actually want to consider dialing back the benefits because they think in the end Germany will pick up the tab for them. So as Germany is to Greece, the future is to America. America doesn't have a German sugar daddy to pick up the bill like the Greeks do. So for America, the future is the sugar daddy. Your unborn grandchildren are the sugar daddy. You've already issued them with credit cards, and those credit cards are already maxed out. But both those and Americans, small government types, supposedly despise what the Greeks do because they're just sticking it to the Germans. But in a certain sense, sticking it to the future is even worse. But they're both symptoms of the same phenomenon, an inability to grasp that these mid-20th century social programs were designed for societies that no longer exist. Toby Pilling writes, would the media narrative on dreamers in the USA be different if they were known by the acronym DIMS, Descendants of Illegal Migrants? I don't care what you call them, as long as you don't call them dreamers. I was on Fox and Friends the other day, and Ainsley referred to dreamers, and I said that I just couldn't bear that. I can't bear the sentimentalization of public policy. And just to go back to what Scott was saying, why do you think nothing ever changes? Nothing ever changes. On the day that everything changed, nothing changed, except we all got to have to take off our shoes when we go to the airport and shuffle through those detectors like a big herd of sheep, flock of sheep. Internal travel within the United States is now absolute hell and will be unto the end of time, because that security dinner theatre is all that anyone is actually seriously prepared to change. One of the reasons for things like this is the absurd sentimentalization of public policy. In what sense are these people dreamers? They're the children of illegal immigrants, some of whom are now in middle age. At the time Obama issued his pardon, as it were, 5 years ago, I think the maximum age you could be was 30. You could be 30 and 11 months and 29 days. So in other words, there are now people who are of 36 who are so-called dreamers. And given the accuracy, given that by definition they're traveling on fake papers, they're undocumented or they're documented with false papers, a lot of them are in their 40s. Why call them dreamers? Because the minute you say dreamers, it means you can take pictures of doe-eyed moppets who were brought here against their will, through no fault of their own. Every dreamer, we're told that the US military is full of dreamers. The children of illegal immigrants are all that's holding up the United States military. Of these 180,000 so-called dreamers, I believe it's fewer than 500 are in the military. Yet to read the media coverage, you would think that the average dreamer is a high school valedictorian who's about to sign on for his first tour in Iraq. It's completely preposterous. And this sentimentalization of public policy is one reason why we cannot think seriously about any of the real issues. Why are they dreamers? You know, because they're romantic. What does it mean? They're romantic. If you're a non-dreamer like me, you go to some boring American government office and they give you a big pile of stupid paperwork that you have to fill in, and you have to provide a lot of boring documentation with that paperwork, and you've got to hand it to a bureaucrat, and the bureaucrat sits on it for years, and then after he's been sitting on it for a few years, he gives it the once-over and he stamps it yay or nay. And obviously that's not being a dreamer, is it? That's not romantic. It's much more romantic to take a flat-bottom skiff across the Rio Grande and just walk into America rather than, I mean, what could be less dreamlike than going to an American government office and filling in the stupid government paperwork? The sentimentalization of public policy on immigration particularly, is why we are where we are at 16 years after 9/11. William Strook says, okay, Stein, so what should we have done after 9/11? Blow Afghanistan all to hell, and then what? Well, there's two ways to approach foreign interventions. If you're an old school imperialist like me, the point is to export your values and, if necessary, impose your values. For example, if the British had not been in India, what would the Indian subcontinent look like now? Well, it would look like the Middle East. It'd be a crazy quilt of not sultans and emirs. It would be Maharajas in the Indian subcontinent and Nizams and things. But it would be the same thing, a crazy quilt of Maharajas and other little statelets where the Maharaja had been toppled and been replaced by this or that dictator. In other words, it would be a disaster. Instead, it's where you call when you need tech support on one of your little electronic gizmos. You come through to Rajiv or Suresh in Bangalore, and they sort out your problem for you. You can thank Lord Macaulay and Her Majesty's government for that, because that's why India is the world's largest democracy and a functioning place. So to old-school imperialists like me, imperialism is worth it. But America does not have an imperialistic bone in its body. And that is something I say with a measure of melancholy and regret, but it is a fact. So the fact of the matter is that we have been in Afghanistan, but for what reason is unclear. We have spent a huge amount of money. So the NATO occupation has been responsible for 98% of Afghanistan's GDP. And I'll give you a good example of where we go wrong on things like that. We've built all these schoolhouses all over Afghanistan. We've built all these schoolhouses. So the buildings are great. They're fantastic. But unlike Lord Macaulay, we have not given a moment of thought to what's taught in those schoolhouses. So what's the point of providing fabulous infrastructure for the incubation of Islamic supremacism, which is what's being taught in those schoolhouses? So there's two ways to look at it. I think this was proposed by John Derbyshire at National Review. His line was, rubble doesn't cause trouble, which is you go there, you blow the place to bits, and then you say you make the mistake of catching our eye again and we'll come and blow you to bits again. Or there's, as I said, the British view, where you basically turn India into a functioning version of a Westminster parliamentary system. But in fact, we haven't done either. On the first night, and this is where it all went wrong, in October 2001, on the first night of the Afghan invasion, Mullah Omar and the Taliban leadership hitched up their skirts and started to skedaddle out of town. And a drone had Mullah Omar's fleeing vehicle from his compound in its sights and was ready to blow Mullah Omar to hell when a guy from CENTCOM said down the wire, "My JAG doesn't like this." If you're not American, a JAG is a judge advocate general. That's to say an army lawyer. And the army lawyer nixed the vaporization of Mullah Omar on the first night of the Afghan invasion. And Donald Rumsfeld was furious about that. He was hopping mad about that. As well he should be. What a coup that would have been. If you're going to go in and you're just going to kill the bad guys and get out, you've got to kill the bad guys. If you're not an imperialist, you've got to kill the bad guys. If you're not an imperialist, you shouldn't be messing around pseudo-nation building, but not really, for 15 years. You know, in other words, building infrastructure like schoolhouses, but not caring a whit what's taught in those schoolhouses. So if you're not an imperialist, don't get into pseudo-nation building. But if you're not an imperialist, you've got to just go in and kill the bad guys. And if you're going in to kill the bad guys, but you don't kill the bad guys because your army lawyer back in Florida doesn't like it, you shouldn't even be doing that either. And that's where I am after 16 years. There's no doubt that America has the most technically advanced armed forces on the planet, technologically advanced. It also has the most highly trained troops on the planet. No doubt about that. There's nothing to compare with U.S. special forces. They do extraordinary things. But there's no point to either the manpower or the technology or the vast budget, if you do not understand the object of war is to crush the enemy's will. And that is the one aspect of this that has gone wrong since day one. Mark Pennington says, it seems a given now that any natural disaster must automatically be met with massive federal relief. I'm all for helping those in need, and I think many of our private organizations are doing a great job trying to help those suffering from our recent hurricanes. However, it seems that this federal relief is having the effect of encouraging and subsidizing those who are the most irresponsible by being underinsured, not preparing, and dependent on big government. Yeah, I would agree with this. I prefer generally that solutions to these things are found close at hand, which is to say I would prefer it if it was state and county and municipal government that provided most of the relief in any natural disaster. One of the encouraging things about both Hurricane Harvey in Texas and Hurricane Irma in Florida is that in neither example was the government corrupt and totally dysfunctional as it was in New Orleans, which was an absolute embarrassment to the United States. And I believe Mayor Nagin is still in jail, as well he should be. But more to the point, he's a creep who should never have been elected to that position of power anyway. But the idea, what was fantastic about, and really tells you about how the left dominates the narrative, is that what happened in Louisiana with Hurricane Katrina is that state and municipal government failed, yet somehow George W. Bush got all the blame. And I don't think that makes any sense, but one consequence of that was that as Harvey brewed and as Irma brewed, the federal government was concerned not to get stuck in the role of designated fall guy as the corrupt and malignant toads who infest Louisiana managed to do with Hurricane Katrina. And as a result of that, I think they have overpromised. And in a sense, this idea of the remote federal government in Washington being the ultimate guarantor for the feckless is actually a dangerous thing. Fish and Chips writes, you've discussed being in Rotherham and speaking to the victims of the Asian grooming scandals. The story keeps getting worse and worse. Is there any hope for this evil town and the wretched servants of officialdom who basically are raping these girls over and over again? How can children consent to abuse? Well, just to take that last point first, Fish and Chips, they're known as white slags, these girls. That's what the packy lads, the so-called Asian grooming gangs, call them. And it's also what the police and large members of local government call them. So they've written off these girls. And as you say, I was in Rotherham last year and I met some of these girls. And one of them, which was shocking to me, one of them mentioned that it was still going on. Her daughter is now of an age to be groomed. It's a horrible way to think of it, but that's Rotherham. And I guess that's one of the consequences of living in Rotherham. And she told me that when she drops her daughter off with her friends, that you can see it's still going on, that cars are cruising with middle-aged men in, and then the car comes around the block again. They're the cars of prosperous men, too. They're BMWs and Mercedes. They're luxury vehicles. And the middle-aged guy comes around in the car, and he is, as they say, quote, Asian, unquote. And then he'll come round again and there'll be a 12 or 13-year-old white girl in the car. And I didn't quite believe this because Rotherham, the only thing anyone who isn't in that particularly grim part of Yorkshire knows about Rotherham is that it's child sex central, that it's a byword for sexual predators. And I didn't quite believe that. So after I'd spoken to this young lady, I went to the particular neighborhood where she said this was going on, and I stood there for about 40 minutes until I had satisfied myself it was not just one isolated vehicle with the middle-aged Asian man and the 12, 13, 14-year-old white girl, but there actually was a succession of those vehicles. It's still going on. It's still going on. And I would say there are two things about this. First, the acts themselves are evil. I'm not even sure that sexual assault covers what's going on there. I look at the elderly British disc jockeys, BBC disc jockeys, who've wound up, and other BBC television and radio talent, who've wound up going to jail because they copped a feel on some 16-year-old girl in 1973 on Top of the Pops. And then I listened to the stories I heard from these girls about being urinated on by groups of men, about being doused in petrol, gasoline, and then these men dancing around them, holding lit matches and threatening to drop them on them, of girls being dangled over balconies by these groups of men. So the level of sexual assault that is going on there is of a degree that's very different from the ones that normally exercise the British media. And there's really, I would say, three things that are going on in Britain. First is the great evil acts themselves that are occurring in Rotherham and other towns. Second is the dishonesty of the media in reporting them, using this euphemism, quote, Asian, unquote, grooming gangs, as if somehow it's Hindus and Tamils and Buddhists, as if somehow it's Indians and Koreans and Chinese and a lot of British subjects who've come in from Hong Kong who are responsible for this. And they all know that it isn't, but they won't actually tell the truth about it. And then the third thing is the ongoing cover-up, the continuing cover-up by the state, by the police, by the social workers, and by local government, and in particular, given that these are generally northern cities, by Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party and its officials. And it is interesting to me that, because I think it is a glimpse of where this is going. And I've heard similarly tales of similarly evasive, dishonest behaviour from officialdom in the Netherlands, Sweden, Germany, elsewhere in Europe. And this is how it's going to be. And you might as well get used to it, that as Europe Islamizes, bureaucrats and officials who are at the best of times not the most courageous of people are going to be co-opted into colluding with evil and in effect providing a support system for evil. That is what happened in Rotherham. And we will see, and we see already similar things happening in Sweden, Germany, Netherlands, and that is disturbing about it. And I would love, nobody would even know about Rotherham if it weren't for, you know, one brave reporter at the London Times and a couple of others. Again, the first thing that happens is you have to be able to tell the truth about what's going on. And increasingly in Britain and in Europe, if you tell the truth, it's Islamophobic, and so you shouldn't be doing it. Let's have a look at this. So Scott Drew says, "What I find funny these days, if it weren't so tragic, is that the lame street media get the people ginned up over so many foolish things, Mencken's hobgoblins like climate change, identity grievances, and of course Trump. When it comes to the real threat from Islam, the response is invariably nothing to see here." I think that's actually a particularly a left-wing thing, Scott, that in fact, the less it matters the more the left is invested in it. And that is why, with climate change, for example, sea levels in the Maldives Islands in the year 2100 are the most pressing challenge facing that world. The less it has, there's two... The left has two approaches to things. It's like it worries about battles that are already won, which is why it's tremendously exercised right now about statues of Robert E. Lee from the U.S. Civil War. Or it's worried about sea levels in the Maldives in the year 2100. Or it's worried about something that applies to such a tiny substratum of society that is barely detectable, like all the LGBTQ, all the initials that come after Q, which are demographic groups that are barely statistically detectable, and yet they count for more than millions and millions of unemployed white men hooked on heroin and meth. That's the left. The less practical application it has to the world we live in, the more they're invested in it. Lawson writes, how should a country like Canada, with a feckless Liberal prime minister, deal with the influx of illegal immigrants from the US, which at present has a leader who's so effective on immigration that illegals are self-deporting and going to Canada? Well, Justin Trudeau made this a distinguishing feature of Canada. You know, the whole point about Canada is that, in the words of his dad, it's a mouse in bed with an elephant. It's a relatively small population country next to a huge population country and sharing a continent with it. And so it values things that differentiate it from the United States. So that's why America has miles and Canada has kilometers. That's why America has a president and Canada is a monarchy. That's why America was a unilingual English-speaking country, so Canada is a bilingual English-French country. What matters is the things you do to the mouse does to distinguish himself from the elephant. So because Trump proposed a Muslim ban, as he did during his campaign, Justin Trudeau differentiated himself from Trump's antipathy to Islam by claiming to mention Islam. He appointed a Somali guy as his immigration minister, which I thought was a joke at first, but actually turned out to be true. There comes a point at which your virtue signaling has real life consequences. Anyone who has been at the border posts, the US-Canadian border posts, know that a lot of these people are skedaddling out of America and walking into Canada. The Olympic Stadium in Montreal, the great big delicious white elephant in the east end of Montreal, is now being used to house the influx of illegal immigrants from the south. And Justin Trudeau is beginning to run up against the limits of virtue signaling. I don't understand, and this really, I think, is worth talking about in maybe doing a signpost on or whatever, why virtue requires you to import millions and millions of people from other countries. I don't even get it. For one thing, we're all supposed to be racist, aren't we? So why bring people to our horrible racist societies? I don't even get that. If they're so talented as we're told they are, wouldn't they be much better off helping? If this Somali guy makes such a great immigration minister, maybe instead of being Canada's immigration minister, he should be Somalia's immigration minister. And again, this is why I go back to Lord Macaulay and the Indian Education Bill and all the rest of it. Because in the end, imperialism has done more for the world than all this bleeding heart liberalism ever will. Let's go to Michael Trueblood. Mark, what would you think about moving the UN to the capital of one of the smaller South American countries? No, no, no. That's still too nice. I want the UN moved to Sudan, Somalia, Yemen. Maybe move it to Benghazi, I think. Scott Scherzer writes, Sitting in a hotel near Dulles Airport. Hopefully we'll be able to get to Miami Beach tomorrow. Thank you for providing a platform to take my mind off of Irma, the hurricane, not the hotel's cocktail waitress. Do you think Irma isn't really a good name? No, nothing against any Irmas who are among our club membership. But I don't know whether that's really a cocktail waitress's name. Just doesn't kind of do it for me. Cocktail umbrella-wise. Anyway, Scott Scherzer writes, do you think Trump's working with Nancy and Chuck will get the congressional Republicans focused on getting the president's agenda enacted? Well, I think all that Trump was trying to do with Nancy and Chuck when he agreed to the three-month postponement of the debt ceiling was to get through Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma time without Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell sticking him with the blame for anything that went wrong. For example, the priority after Hurricane Harvey hit was to get FEMA. FEMA's budget was supposed to run out. So FEMA, you know, FEMA, these are the guys, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. These are the guys standing up on TV every minute in Texas and Florida saying, not to worry, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. Well, FEMA's budget was supposed to run out. And at that point, they would have exactly $0 in their bank account, and they wouldn't actually be able to write a check for any of this stuff. And quite reasonably enough, Trump did not trust, given the pig's ear that they've made of everything so far, he did not trust Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell not to be having stupid, pointless debates on the debt ceiling and shutting down the government at a time when condo developments in South Florida were breaking away from the coast and floating out into the ocean. And there's Granny standing on the roof waiting to be rescued by a Coast Guard helicopter. And back at the House of Representatives, they're having an argument over the debt ceiling. He didn't trust Paul Ryan. By the way, I'll reprise a cheap joke I made when I was on Rush the other day. People talk about Category 4 and Category 5 hurricanes, and what's the official definition of a Category 6 hurricane? And that's when Mitch McConnell's face betrays a sense of urgency. These guys are supposed to be parliamentary guys, and you're in the arithmetic business if you're doing that. You know, Mitch McConnell has nothing to recommend him to anyone except for the fact that he can do his arithmetic, and he got the arithmetic wrong on the Obamacare vote twice. And Trump didn't want to go to trust Mitch McConnell's arithmetic a third time. Now, the bigger danger here is that there isn't really any partnership with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. They're waiting to impeach him. And they'll be quite happy to impeach him. They'll do a deal with him on Tuesday and vote to impeach him on Wednesday. They don't care about that. But the bigger problem is that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell have been trying to turn somebody who ran essentially as a third-party candidate into a cookie-cutter rhino president like George Bush Sr. And the danger for me is that with Scott Bannon and Sebastian Gorka and all the red meat guys who are in the White House out, that in fact Trump will be neutered, spayed, gelded, and turned into Jeb Bush light. And I do worry about that without Bannon and the other red meat guys actually in the building. You need them inside the tent, urinating out to clean up the old line, rather than outside the tent, no matter how effective they are. Yiddle with a Fiddle writes, oh, if you could sing a duet with any living or deceased singer, who would it be? Also, is there any chance that you and Marvin might record a Haddocker song? I occasionally toy with Haddocker songs. I'm a bit off the whole, which is now the holiday concert at most American schoolhouses, where you have either have no religious content whatsoever, or you have basically something from every tradition. So, you know, they'll do Santa Claus is Coming to Town, and then they'll do a Hanukkah song, and then they'll do Death to the Infidel or whatever for any of, you know, Muslim children that happen to be there, whatever. Anyway, living or deceased singer. I would have loved to have sung a duet with Dinah Shore, because Dinah was a great duettist, fabulous duettist. I don't know whether Dinah would have loved to do a duet with me, though. But Dinah could sing with just about anybody, and I have no doubt she could have handled anything I threw at her. So thank you for that. I love Dinah Shore's voice, and Dinah made great solo records. Her album with Andre Previn is one of those great. What my old program director used to call bearskin rug music. You put that on a hi-fi high and the lights down low, and you can't go wrong with that album. Dinah sings, Andre Previn plays at the piano, and you can't go wrong with that. But Dinah, aside from all that bearskin rug music, Dinah could also duet with just about any singer. So she'd be good. Also, on a musical note, David Wilson writes, on a lighter note, I remember that you recently mentioned the second A-side of a single. How was it decided that a single would have a second A-side rather than a B-side? Well, if you're under a certain age, you won't remember singles. If you're under 50, do you remember CDs now? It's been so long. But before they had digital downloads and before they had CDs, they used to have singles, and there would be an A-side, which was the song you heard on the radio, and there would be a B-side, which was the kind of filler track that nobody ever played and was just there because there were two sides to a record. So you had something on one side and you had to have something on the other. So if you take a song like, what was a big baby boom pop hit? Who was that? The Angels? Who was it who did My Boyfriend's Back? I think it was The Angels, something like that. Girl group, My Boyfriend's Back. And that was the A side and it was a great song. And nobody knew what was on the B side. I think it was My Boyfriend's Front. That's an old joke. But I thought I'd throw it in there because no one's done it in 50 years. Anyway, that's how it used to go, the A side and the B side. I don't think I actually referred to the second A side of a single, David. What we used to have is double A sides. And that's where... sometimes and the record company would generally do this by accident. they'd waste two good songs on one single, and the disc jockeys would suddenly start playing the B side, and that is why I sometimes refer to not second A side but double A side. Because sometimes there were two A sides to a single and no B sides. But anyway, that's all B sides. The point. Paulie writes, it was great to get the print version of the Clubbable Stein in the post last week. This is our new newsletter. I mentioned that I'd been in Rotherham, and in fact, the centre pages of the Clubbable Stein are all about my trip to Rotherham and meeting with these young ladies. But there's also lots of other stuff in there on climate change. We've got a little bit of a round of Know Your Ensigns, using the ensigns of some of our far-flung Mark Stein Club members. We also have the Benghazi and Diana anniversaries. We've got a tale of an amazing version of Joseph and the amazing Jew-free dream coat that New Zealand attempted to do. And again, I'll tie that back to Rotherham while I'm at it, because it's part of the same thing. The people who collude with the sexual exploitation in Rotherham are themselves evil. So just to be clear what I'm saying here, Rotherham has evil policemen, evil social service workers, evil council members. They collude with great evil. But there's a kind of easy listening version of that, of which was going on in New Zealand, and which I mention in the Clubbable Stein, in which there was a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat by my old pals Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, in which the lyrics were changed to avoid any mention of Israel. And to their credit, when Tim and Andrew heard about this back in London, they got hopping mad about it and forced the local council in New Zealand to back down. But it's the same thing. It's actually the same phenomenon, the same weakness, the same inability to stand up for so-called liberal values and instead to just shrug and go along with great wickedness. And there's stories like that all around the world. All around the world. Laura Rosa Cohen writes, my 9/11 question is, why the hell are we still shedding blood for these barbarians? And she quotes this newspaper story. Quote, 5 U.S. troops were wounded Monday when a suicide bomber drove a car bomb into an armored convoy outside Bagram Air Base in northern Afghanistan. Unquote. You could drive around outside Bagram Air Base in the fall of 2001. You can't now. Things are getting worse. It's the crusader fort mentality, the idea that you have these bases, you hold up in these bases, inside these bases, you got your Dunkin' Donuts, your Burger King. It's like a little mini bit of an, it's like an American strip mall in the middle of hell. And outside, you can't do anything, you can't go anywhere. And there's no point to that. And 24 hours after the last Western soldier leaves Afghanistan, it will be as if we were never there. What should we go to now? Oh yeah, big trans got no plans. Have we hit peak trans yet? Is there such a thing? Asking for a friend. And he adds, WWTMS, what would the Mullahs say? And this is a story out of Breitbart.com in which the Christian parents are suing the school over so-called gender change identity. I think this is evil too, actually. Nobody knows, because this is a big experiment now, this urge to get kids transitioning earlier and earlier. So we're not waiting for adolescence anymore, but your kids should start transitioning. Don't wait till the age of 12. Don't wait till the age of 10. Don't wait till the age of 8. Let's start transitioning them 7, 6, 5, 4. It's, again, this is wicked, and it's being done in the cause of social engineering. Being a child can be a very confusing thing, particularly and all kinds of things can change it. If you're an only child, if you're a younger boy with an older sister, if you're the youngest of maybe 3 kids and there's a huge gap between you and the next one, all kinds of things can affect your development as a child. The difference now is that in the old days, you come home and you find your boy has somehow gotten into his sister's room and he's pulled on one of her princess dresses and he's wandering around in it and he thinks it's a great joke. And it's a phase. It's cute, it's funny, it's a phase, doesn't mean anything. 2 months' time, he's going to go back to playing with G.I. Joe or whatever. Except the difficulty now is that there will be enormous pressure to say that this is somehow your boy's biological identity does not align with his gender identity, and so to pump him full of hormones and prepare him to transition. There was a heartbreaking story in the other day, actually about, I forget the name of it, but about one of these trans celebrities, a woman. She still has her penis, as a lot of women do these days. But she has, as I understand it, an adolescent penis because she's like been pumped full of hormones at a certain point. So you can't reverse that because if they give you some of these treatments before adolescence and then you change your mind, you can never recover your traditional physiological development. So you will always, you can wind up not being fully functioning in either sex, as it were. And again, I think that this is something where that no one had heard of the day before yesterday. It used to be quite a rarefied thing. People who were unhappy, they'd had maybe unhappy adolescence, and they were still unhappy in their mid-20s, late-20s, and then they went off to Morocco or somewhere, and they had an operation, and they lived their lives as a member of the opposite sex, usually as a woman. It's 9 out of 10 of these so-called, what we used to call sex changes, are men becoming women, and 1 out of 10 is a woman becoming a man. So there's 9 Caitlyn Jenners for every 1 Chaz Bono. And I think that's not an irrelevant statistic, because at heart, that's what it's about. It's a massive transfer from manhood into non-male identities, which is basically what the social engineers are most concerned with. And in a sense, the more the social engineers do of that, as you know, if you go to school, to any grade school in America and most other parts of the Western world, boyishness is suppressed. Boyishness, roughhousing, running around the playground, getting into scrapes, Tom Sawyer type stuff is now frowned upon, which I don't think is unrelated, actually, to boys figuring, God almighty, I've been handed the loser card of life. I'd much rather be like Cindy May. But at heart, behind it, is a massive transfer from the manned side of society to the unmanned side, and in that sense, no, we haven't reached peak trans yet. There is still going to be a long, long way to go on that. Jeff G writes, "What will it take for the slow flood of the growing influence Silicon Valley oligarchs and their spying, controlling, ubiquitous app devices to be recognized and countered? Facebook, Google, Amazon, Microsoft. How can this end well? I have little trust that the DOJ will take this up, much less be able to have any positive effect." Yeah, basically now everybody, the telephone is an amazing thing now. The telephone is basically an electronic ankle bracelet that everybody in the planet is walking around with. And if you look at the collusion between these so-called tech monopolies and government, the idea that that will have no consequences is absurd. I increasingly think that the flowering of the internet in the late 90s and the early aughts will be a moment. Almost 20 years ago now, I guess, it seemed like an incredible liberating moment. If you wanted to say something, you didn't need to persuade a publisher, whether you're talking about the New York Times or Simon & Schuster, to let you say it, or ABC News to let you say it. Anybody could say it. Anybody could say anything. And I think that period is already over now. And we're moving into an age where the internet will increasingly be a system for state control. And in Europe particularly, it's extremely disturbing what's happening. There's no longer even a pretense of deference to the concept of freedom of speech. All those creepy, grubby, slimy little twerps who pretended to be sad at the Charlie Hebdo deaths and marched in Paris. People like Angela Merkel, who is no friend of free speech. Theresa May is no friend of free speech. They all marched and pretended to be marching for free speech when the guys bust in and killed the Charlie Hebdo guys. But increasingly, they're ever more openly contemptuous of free speech, and they're ever more comfortable with regulating speech and using these tech monopolies, which is what they are. This is basically the people you've named: Facebook, Google, Amazon, Microsoft. This is a cartel. You know, why was it necessary to break up Standard Oil in 1907? They never had anything like the reach and market share that, say, Google does or Facebook does? Why haven't Facebook and Google been broken up? I mean, if trust busting was necessary to John D. Rockefeller in 1907, why isn't it necessary, the same treatment necessary for this Facebook guy, Zuckerberg? Because this Facebook guy, Zuckerberg, is actually colluding with people like Angela Merkel in suppressing free speech. So I don't think this is going to end well. And I think that flowering of the internet in the late 90s and the aughts, it already seems as if we're moving into a different and more restrictive phase now. Midwestern Tim writes, why are Canadians and Brits so much better at using the English language to cut down their opponents in witty ways? Americans have mastered the four-letter words, but that's about it. Where did our education system fail us? Well, actually, if you've ever wandered around a football stadium after the big Saturday match, you'll know that the English are no strangers to four-letter words, Midwestern Tim. I don't know that. I think Canada, my theory on Canada, which I talked about with Mordecai Richler and others from time to time, and there's a kind of agreement about this, is it goes back to that mouse in bed with an elephant thing. The reason why so many Canadians prosper in the United States, particularly in the comedy field, doesn't matter whether you're talking about Jim Carrey, Leslie Nielsen, whoever you have in mind, is because it's the mouse in bed with the elephant. We're all lined up on the 49th parallel. We're looking into the candy store, but we're not in the candy store. We're on the outside looking in. And being on the outside looking in, I think, is often gives you a sideways way of looking at things that can be very droll. I think when we're talking about the metropolitan power in England, it's a slightly different thing, because the English, I put in a word for British imperialism back at the top of this show, but the English are the kind of most self-effacing dominant power that there's ever been. They're not a very rah-rah. They were never, even at the imperial peak, a very kind of rah-rah culture, and they just kind of slightly deplored full-on kind of jingoistic nationalism. They always found that faintly ridiculous, and I think that kind of faint sense of one's own ridiculousness can stand you in good sense. But then if you take the Australians or the Irish or the Indians, the Indian newspapers are beautifully written and actually very drolly written too. So I don't know whether it's I think there are different strains of English that are useful in particular circumstances. But I wouldn't diminish your own contribution, Midwestern Tim. Midwesterners can suffer perhaps because they can sometimes be too nice, but Midwesterners, precisely because they're expected to be nice, sometimes when they're not so nice, it can be incredibly pointed and without actually using all those four-letter words that you do deplore. By the way, I'm so bored with four-letter words. Four-letter words. And what I can't, just to go back to complaining about the internet, one of the things I find odd is this guy. Like I was on Rush the other day, and after Rush, I always get a lot of people who listen to me, and they hate Rush, and so they find that Rush isn't there, so they want to hate me. And so they Google around and they find an email address for me. And then they send me an email going, hey, F you, you blank, blank, you blank, you, what the blank do you think, you blankety blanking, you mother blanker, you blank blanker, blankety blank, 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 blank. And then they send you this thing, and then 10 minutes later you get another email saying, ha, you don't have the guts to respond to me, do you? No, actually, I don't bother talking to people who cannot express, because the thing about words, if you value words, you also value the F word, say, and because you value language. And that means that by definition, you don't devalue words by using them in the wrong context. And one of the things that has gone horribly wrong with our culture is that they have is that by reducing it to just a handful of four-letter epithets, they have not only diminished their own articulatedness, but they have also diminished any power that those four-letter epithets might have had. So that compared to what they were 50 years ago or 100 years ago, they are now utterly worthless. And I'll give you an example of that. In my small town, the Historical Society published some letters from a couple of guys who were good at playing the trumpet and other musical instruments, and they got into a touring band in the 1840s and toured around America. So they fell in with a lot of itinerant traveling musicians, and they wrote back home to their friends in town, and the nice little old ladies who run the Historical Society collected together the letters. And there's a point in all these letters, one point, they're talking about playing for Chester Van Buren at one, not Chester Van, Martin Van Buren. I can't tell you guys with your presidents, I can't keep one president straight from another. Martin Van Buren, they're playing for him at one point. And a couple of weeks later, they write home again. And there's a slightly risky off-color joke about an hotel made in this letter. And the fact of the matter is that it makes you realize how corruption of social norms actually makes the small pleasure of a mildly risque joke totally impossible. Because it's like it seems naughty and daring in the context of these 19th century letters home. Today, it would just be lost in a blizzard of F-words, and that's very sad. Thank you for all your questions today. We'll get to some of the ones we didn't get to in a special video edition of Mark's Mailbox. And do join me later this evening for another episode of our Joseph Conrad serialization, a book that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 was cited widely in the American and global media because of the insights it provides into the psychology of terrorists. If you haven't yet followed our serialization of Joseph Conrad's novel, The Secret Agent, I hope you will join us tonight and catch up. And as for this edition of Clubland Q&A, join us in a couple of days for Mark's Mailbox, and we will see you next time.